So here we are again on another holiday morning on our retreat. I always remember the last few words of the word retreat. Treat. So this will be nice and fun. But also, not just fun, but also meaningful as well. Because this morning I wanted to talk about the role of what we call insight in meditation. I know there's many traditions actually keep on calling like retreats insight meditation retreats, insight meditation retreats, insight. And sometimes when they see me talking in this manner of teaching how to be calm, they think that I just teach calm. But Ajahn Chah would always say time and time again that you cannot split calm and insight. So wherever there's calm, there's insight. Wherever there's insight, there's calm. And he said it was like just the two edges of a Thai machete, which was one was blunt, the other one was sharp. You might say like two sides of a coin. But sure enough, you may be focusing on one side of the coin, but the other side of the coin is right there underneath. And whichever side of the coin you're focusing on, you're bringing the other one along with you. And indeed, the calm always does come with insight. The insight comes with calm. And a good measure of how much insight one has is how calm one can become. Because the whole purpose of insight and the true sense of the word is to be able to see through the attachments which cause problems and difficulties and suffering in the body and in the mind. You want to get insight into those things, not just to know them so you can write books about them, but so they can actually work and heal the problems of life, heal the problems of existence. And the basic teaching of Buddhism is that through ignorance, through delusion, through not seeing clearly, therefore we suffer. It's from delusion, from ignorance, from not seeing clearly, that we grasp over these things which we think is going to cause us freedom and happiness, but they just cause us more entrapment and more difficulty and suffering. So we're following wrong things. And so the insight is something which is supposed to be seeing this, uncovering the causes for difficulty, for problems, for lack of happiness, and untying those bonds, freeing yourself. So the side of insight is always calm and happiness. So if you see anyone who's teaching insight and they're a misery guts, always getting angry, then they've got no insight at all. If they could really see, why don't they do something about it? So the sign of insight is calm and happiness. And what's the sign of calm? Because sometimes the people can say they get very peaceful in their meditation. And you know, we don't turn the lights on in the morning. They say they've had a very peaceful meditation. But sometimes you turn the lights on, their peaceful meditation is like this. they're asleep. And after the peaceful meditation, they've got no sharpness, no clarity, but their mind is still dull. That's a sure sign that calm hasn't happened. However, on the opposite of that, if someone has got into a nice state of meditation and calm, then when they come out afterwards, they're bright, energetic, happiness, and they can just contemplate so easy, that's a sign that they've entered calm. The ability to practice insight is a measure of how calm you've got. A measure of insight is calm, a measure of calm is insight. That's why that you check people, as a meditation teacher, using the simile of going up the mountain. How calm do you feel? I feel very calm. How far can you see? And they say, how far can you see? How calm do you feel? Because those two always go together. So always remember, you cannot split calm and insight, insight and calm. Even in the suttas, it's the same. There's no split between those two. So whatever you focus on, if you focus on insight and think you're doing an insight retreat, you're going to get calm if you're practicing insight properly. If you're practicing calm and you think you're not doing insight, you are. You get more and more insightful. I've already mentioned to you just how to, during this retreat, go and use nature as a way of developing happiness and beauty. But you can only do that when you've got a degree of calm and you can actually stay long enough with an aspect of nature to really see the beauty there. I often tell that story, I've mentioned it before here, that my first meditation retreat, which I went to, was in Cambridge in a bedsit. And every morning we'd go for a walk for 1 hour and I'd go for this clump of bamboo. And at that clump of bamboo, I went to the botanical gardens. But at the entrance to that botanical gardens was a clump of bamboo, and every morning, even though I was supposed to be going for exercise, I couldn't get past that clump of bamboo. Because every time I looked at it, it just literally opened up, and I just saw so much beauty and so much to entrance me there that I ended up standing and then sitting on a nearby bench and looking at a clump of bamboo for 1 hour every morning for 10 days. And that's supposed to be my exercise. And the reason I couldn't go past it, because it was so amazingly beautiful, it was so interesting, it was so delightful, that I was just entranced. And a few days after the retreat had finished, rather a few weeks after the retreat had finished, I decided to go back to the botanical gardens and just see that clump of bamboo again. When I went back there after a few weeks, I looked at that clump of bamboo and it was just an ordinary clump of bamboo again. As it were, it had closed and I couldn't see anything anymore. And that really showed me just the power of calm to develop insight. When the mind is very peaceful, you've got the mind calm, you can see so much deeper into things. That's the nature. Calm is the cause for insight to arise. I also gave a simile earlier on in this retreat about walking up the hillside to our monastery. The faster you go, the less you understand what you're seeing. The slower you go, the more you see, and with nature, the more beauty you see. And if you stop and just gaze without thinking, without the mind moving, you can see enormously deeply into that nature. And it's captivating, it's beautiful. And it doesn't matter how many times you pass that hillside, when you stop, you see it as if for the first time. No matter how many times I pass that clump of bamboo, if I wasn't still, I could not see it. And this actually shows you how insight arises. So there's two types of insight in this sense. There's insight based on thinking. And that's the sort of insight we argue over. And we have all sorts of theories about and make religions out of. But that's just all thinking and words. It's just relationships between the labels. That's all. But for true insight, you need to be absolutely silent to really allow nature to teach you. That old Buddhist saying, that I don't think it's a Taoist saying, that he who knows doesn't say, and he who says doesn't know. You've heard that one before? Those in Perth have heard this, because I always rebel against these old sayings and I add my own. And of course, the third line of that, he who says doesn't know, he who knows doesn't say. The third line is, whoever said that didn't know. It's logical, isn't it? So all this saying, that's where we get some of the philosophies, and that's not insight. That's where we get the smart sayings, but they don't actually do anything to us in our lives. That's where we get the religions, which people worship, but doesn't actually change the way they behave. So insight goes far deeper than that, but you do need to have the calm. But sometimes people say, well, what should you do first then? Should you do calm first and then insight, insight then calm? What should you do first? Whatever you think you're doing, you're always going to be doing both at the same time. And it's important to, as you're practicing your meditation, also to practice insight at the same time. The insight supports the calm supports the insight. What we mean here is that as you are practicing your meditation, as you're doing this retreat, don't just go at the meditation technique just like a ball without any wisdom. This is something which should be always looking and seeing what is going on. If there's an obstacle, what is that obstacle? Why is that obstacle? How is that obstacle overcome? This is like the practicing of insight which supports the meditation. It's how wisdom creates peace. And the way we do this practically in our meditation is that at the very least, at the end of every meditation, for 2 or 3 minutes, you should not just finish your meditation and get up and have a cup of tea or go to the toilet or go walk meditation. At the end of every meditation, please put aside 2 or 3 minutes at the minimum where you look back, where you reflect on what you've done and what you haven't done, what worked and what didn't work, what the result was of this meditation. Because without that reflection, there's no possibility for insight to arise which will illuminate the path of meditation for you. When I was starting meditation, started doing my meditation retreats, had some good meditations at first, then after a year or two I started to get dull and I didn't think I was getting anywhere in my meditation. And I started doing less and less meditation. I was meditating very regularly, you know, in my college years, but then afterwards, you know, just other things were going on in my life and it's hard to find the time and I didn't think I was getting anywhere and that made me meditate less and less. Until someone pointed out to me that, are you really reflecting on what meditation is doing for you? And I realized that I wasn't. I was meditating in the morning and then as soon as my meditation was finished, I didn't think it was getting anywhere, I'd get up and get my breakfast and get ready to do whatever I needed to do. But I wasn't spending time just reflecting, knowing what this was doing to me. And so I took that on board and I started putting aside 2 or 3 minutes, end of every meditation, just to say, well, how do I feel now? What's happened after this meditation? And I was actually surprised, very pleasantly surprised, that out of every meditation, meditations even I thought were hopeless, I'd actually got something out of it. I was much more peaceful than when I started. I was much more alert than when I started. I was much happier than when I started. Not as happy as I wanted to be, not as alert as I wanted to be, not as peaceful as I wanted to be, but there was still an effect there which I could know very clearly. And once I started seeing that effect, it gave me confidence. Yeah, meditation was still working. And all of you who find it hard to meditate and you think you're getting nowhere, always try that insight practice at the end of every meditation. Even the bad meditations, just stop, pause for 2 or 3 minutes. You're not trying to watch the breath or do anything, you're just trying to find out how you feel. And compare it to how you felt when you began. And look, I guarantee that 99.9% of your meditations will be effective. And it'll give you confidence. Hey, I might not be able to get into jhanas and float through the air, but I can actually get something out of this. I can do it. Something is happening. Not only does it give you confidence, but it shows you what is happening. Because when we talk about insight, most insight is just thinking and ideas. But when you actually stop at the end of a meditation and just look, what you're actually looking at mostly is qualities of mind we call freedom, happiness, contentment, peace. And those are things which many people talk about in this world. And they always talk how much they want peace, how much they want happiness, how much they want freedom. We write the word freedom into our constitutions, but we don't know a thing about what that actually means. And that's why that so many people think they're free in this world. Whereas the way I look at it, everyone is just so entrapped. That's why the attachments, there's what tie you down. The defilements, the Buddha called fetters, the same word to describe these ball and chains which people tie around you in the olden days when they put you in jail. And the Buddha was saying that all you guys and girls, you're fettered. You're carrying around balls and chains with you. Take them off. We don't want to take them off. They're nice. I got my own special ball and chain. no one else has got a ball and chain like mine. It's just it's so important to me. I've carried this around for so long. You know, it's got sentimental value to me. This particular ball and chain was given to me on my wedding day. I went through a lot of pain to give birth to this ball and chain. But these are called fetters, but we don't want to let them go. Because you have to actually to see very clearly to be able to really get insight. Or when we actually get to the end of a meditation, we can actually see a sense of freedom, a sense of peace, a sense of liberation. And it's very important to actually to get that insight into what peace actually means. Otherwise, we'd be searching for peace in our life, never really know what it was searching for. It's just an idea, not a thing. And when actually peace comes along, because we don't know it, we'll miss it. And we'll sort of discard it. Or when freedom comes along, we have the opportunity to be free. Because we don't recognize it, we don't take that opportunity and chance, and it's gone. And it takes a long time for freedom to come up again. When happiness comes, and happiness is there for you, as I was saying, it's in the trees, it's in even the carpet here, especially it's in this moment. But then we don't take it, we want some other type of happiness, what people say is happiness. We miss the opportunity because we don't know what these things are. So the insight, the end of a meditation, is not only showing you that meditation is working for you, but it's also insight to these important qualities, which everyone is searching for, but which people don't know what they are. Obviously, the calmer you are, the more those qualities shine for you. Now, the more real they are, the more deep they are. However, even in the beginning, it's good just to notice them, even though they're pretty vague and their outline is not clear to you. If it's only like a sniff, a whiff of these qualities, but it's still important. Because it's starting to reveal to you sort of what is available through this practice of meditation. Not only is there a sense of freedom, there's a great sense of wisdom and understanding that this is real, you're beginning to see things. And it should give you that understanding, that insight, that to really become wise, you should stop thinking and stop trying to analyze everything. We've got this really weird delusion in our society that the most wise people are the great thinkers. That's what you call it, like the great thinkers of our society. But they're not wise at all, as far as I'm concerned. It's the great no-thinkers. They're the wise people. Because they start to see things not as other people say they are, because all thinking is completely conditioned. Now you think as you've been taught to think. You've been brainwashed into thinking that particular way. And if actually you look at your thought patterns, you can actually trace them back where they came from. You know, from what you heard from somebody else. From, you know, what your parents or teachers or other influential people in your life said. You tend to think in the same channels as they did. And it's not really seeing clearly. It's just repeating. So the real clear thinkers, or rather the real clear thinkers are those who are clear of thinking, can actually see. There's an old simile which used to use in Thailand a long time ago, which is the simile of like the leaves in the forest. In the forest monasteries of northeast Thailand, they're in a jungle. And I already mentioned that sometimes you'd have to walk back from the hall to your huts in the evening, and sometimes without flashlights, sometimes without sandals in the early days. So the monks would be very diligent in actually sweeping the paths during the middle of the day. Because when you swept the paths of all the leaves, if there was a snake on the path, you could actually, you know, see its silhouette against the white sand of northeast Thailand. And so this used to be an important part of the chores, to sweep all the paths, so you could see where you were going, even in the dark. And of course, as soon as you started sweeping the path, and get all the leaves and the twigs which had fallen the day before off the path, then the path actually became this beautiful, like almost gleaming white line, ribbon through the jungle. But usually what happened, as soon as you finished sweeping a section of that path, you know, a leaf would fall down right in the middle of it. And of course, being a perfectionist, you turn around and you sweep that off again. It really bothered you. And you know, you turn around, another leaf would fall on. So you'd always sort of going back on what you'd already done until you became white and just left it. But that used to be a common problem with all people, including the Thais. And so monks like Ajahn Chah would notice this and would actually point that out. Why did that leaf stand out? And it stood out because it was alone, surrounded just by this great empty area of no leaves, the path which had been swept. That's why it stood out so much. That's why you could see it so clearly. That's why you could see its shape, its colour, with far greater clarity than if you looked at a leaf in the jungle surrounded by hundreds of thousands and millions of other leaves. He said, that's like insight. The insight, you have to sweep the path, first of all, to make it so clean and clear, so there's nothing there. To make the mind empty, free, no thoughts, nothing going on at all. It's like sweeping the path. Then when the first leaf falls down on that empty mind, then it stands out so clearly. You can see its shape, its colour, you can understand everything about it. In the same way, when the first experience alights on the empty mind, it stands out so clearly, you have an opportunity to fully understand what's going on. But if an experience is surrounded by hundreds, thousands, millions of other experiences, it's just too much, it's just too confusing. You can never truly understand what is occurring. So that is why at the end of a meditation, the calmer you are, the more empty is your path, then when the first thoughts start to come up, the first experiences after quiet meditation start to come up, that's the time you can really get to know them and understand them. Getting to know them and understand them is almost like seeing them from a different perspective, what you haven't seen before. Because for insight to arise, we want new knowledge, not old knowledge. The old knowledge, what we've been taught before, what we've heard from the books, it hasn't really worked yet. We're not fully enlightened, we're not fully free, we're not fully happy. So we've got to see things a bit deeper. So when those things arise after mind, after meditation, you know, you've done your reflection after meditation, see what happens. And then you'll be able to see it much deeper. You'd also be able to hold it much longer so you can fully penetrate it. To give that full simile of holding something up, those of you who haven't done this before, it's very well worth doing this little experiment. You hold something up, what is this? And just watch what the mind does when you go through this process, what is this? And all of the labels which come up first of all, is cup, it's round, it's white, it's this shape, that shape. That's all your old knowledge, what you were taught when you were young at school. Your teacher showed you a picture of a cow and said, that's cow, that's daddy, that's house, that's tree. That's where all those ideas are coming from. If you keep looking long enough, all those labels become exhausted, and then you've got an opportunity of seeing it for what it truly is, beyond the labels. Sometimes it takes a long time. With the practice of insight, you have to be able to sustain your attention long enough, be patient enough, to be able to allow whatever it is you're holding up to really open out to you. Just like that clump of bamboo, when I saw it as bamboo, that was just not even a minuscule of a percent of what that thing was when I watched it. If I allowed it to open up to me, for days, an hour every morning, I went in there and it was just still teaching me things. Once when I was in Thailand, I was doing, this was during a retreat period, I was walking meditation. And because it was the monsoon season, we'd walk meditation inside the hall. in Thailand. And at that time, the hall just had a concrete floor. Those of you who went with me to Northeast Thailand a few weeks ago, it's covered with these plastic tiles now. But underneath those plastic tiles is some amazing concrete. Because what actually happened was I was walking meditation, mind was getting very still. And you know when you're walking meditation, putting all your attention on your feet, with your sight just a couple of meters in front of you, gazing down at the ground. And I was doing this, my mind was getting more and more peaceful, just focusing on the feet. But it was also half aware of what I was looking at. And I had to stop, because I was watching the concrete, and then the concrete started to get more and more beautiful. And as if your perception started to really dive into that concrete. And it became amazing, just the beauty, the texture, the different colors and shades of gray which were there. And I was just spellbound, I don't know how long. And that little piece of concrete which I'd walked over day after day after day became one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen in my life. And I wanted to actually to cut it out and send it to the National Art Gallery, hang it on the wall. But it was an amazing experience, and again I reflected upon what was going on there, because afterwards when the mind wasn't so peaceful I couldn't see anything anymore. What was going on there? Was I going crazy? But what happens then is because of calm, you can actually see much deeper than what you expect. Everybody knows that concrete is ugly. Right? You have this idea of cities being the concrete jungle. And where we do have some concrete, we want to cover it up with a carpet or with tiles or something, because concrete is not the sort of thing which you hang on your wall. And you hang these pictures of flowers and birds, but there's no pictures of concrete hanging on the wall of this place. Why is that? Because of our ideas, what's been conditioned into us. And what insight does, it completely sort of goes in the opposite direction to that. And when you're very calm, you start to look at something and it starts to, as I say, opens up to you. You see this amazing experience just in a piece of concrete. And each of the inside experiences, the real ones, are always accompanied by this wonderful bliss and happiness. Wow, this is great. So this is actually how you get insight into concrete. It's one of the great stages of insight to the path to enlightenment. The insight into the nature of concrete. What we're really saying though, this is just what happens. It's part of the path. And if this does happen to you, and maybe it's happened to you in small ways, especially because nature is just so beautiful anyway, naturally, that you may have gone out there into the garden after a nice meditation and wow, that sky, you've never seen it so blue, brilliantly blue. And that grass, wow, that's amazing. And you can just go and look at that grass like you once did as a child. Just completely captivated by the beauty, by the shape, by the texture, by the softness of just one blade of grass. Just look at it for hours. So if I see any of you just out there in the garden going, wow, 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 as you're looking at sort of a little twig, then I know your meditations are going well. But this is just what happens when you get calm. The mind expands, you can see deeper, you can hold things longer, and nature starts to teach you. This is actually an important sign that you're getting the muscles of insight strong, the doors of the mind are opening so you can start to see things. And eventually that you'll turn that attention not just to clumps of bamboo and concrete, you'll turn that insight, that attention into the more important things of life. Especially that, you know, you're living in the world, lay people, you start to turn that attention into, you know, your lifestyle, your relationships. Because sometimes we need to get great insight into those things which concern us and trouble us the most. Now, all these like monks and nuns you meet who are supposed to be wise people, all their insights and wisdom, they didn't come from books, they didn't come from training course, they came from sitting quietly cross-legged and making the mind very peaceful. It was amazing going to see someone like Ajahn Chah, and this guy was so wise. And, you know, I don't know where he learnt that from. He didn't go to any sort of classes or universities and get degrees in counselling and therapy and psychology and goodness knows what else. But this guy was so amazingly wise. Say, like, as a therapist. Only Ajahn Chah could do this. It's one of his amazing stories. There's this, whenever there was any problems in the village, because he was basically the local wise man, they'd always, you know, take the problem to him to solve. And one day there was this lady got possessed. And the villagers could do nothing with her. She was actually literally foaming at the mouth, screaming at the top of her voice. It took three or four big men from the village to even like half control her. And she was almost like possessed by a demon. She was absolutely violently crazy. And so they took her to see Ajahn Chah. And one of the men came in front, and all the monks, he could hear her screaming from a long way off. You know, this great noise and yelling at the top of her voice, and quite sort of profane, swearing, really uncouth language, and struggling and foaming at the mouth, and incredible energy when you get crazy or mad like that. And of course, Ajahn Chah had never had any training in sort of trauma counselling or this counselling or anything. So what did he do? Straight away, he told the novice to go and boil some water. And he told another of the lay people, they go and dig a hole. And monks were wondering, who's going crazy here? What's he doing? If you get a crazy person, what do you mean, like boiling some water and digging a hole? But he ordered these novices, come on, I want a lot of water. You know, had his big sort of pots, about three or four pots of boiling water, and I want it quickly. And that hole, I want it to be deep, about 3 or 4 feet deep. Now, dig it now, quick. You know, put some effort into it. And all this time, they were dragging this lady to him. And she didn't want to go. She was screaming, and she was yelling, and swearing. And when they brought her to him in the sort of the room there, or underneath his hut where he used to receive guests, and she was really going crazy. He said, is the water boiled yet? Dig the hole deeper. I've got to bury this lady in the hole, pour the water over her, and then sort of cover her up. That's the only way to cure her. Now, there's one thing that even though you were a monk with Ajahn Chah, you never knew what he was going to do next. And he might do that. And all the villagers knew the same. And as soon as he started saying this, the woman started getting less agitated and started to calm down. And he said, come on, is that water boiled yet? The hole needs to be digger. We've got to put this lady in. That's the only way we can get the spirit out. We've got to pour boiling water over it and then bury it alive. And before the hole was dug, before the water had boiled, she'd calmed down and she was peaceful. And then he gave her the five precepts and she walked away. That's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Now, those of you who've done counselling courses, have you ever heard of that? Because this was a monk who had a very deep insight into the nature of the mind and what was really going on, even if it was possession. There is something inside the human mind, and I mentioned it yesterday, called self-preservation, which is stronger than madness. And if you can get to that self-preservation, that will conquer the madness. In a much lesser case, there was one fellow who was going through one of these acrimonious divorces, and he went crazy, and he was suicidal, and I spent the whole day with him. And I couldn't do very much for him. He was giving a bit of loving kindness and being with him, but he started getting crazier and crazier, and eventually started getting violent. So he had to call the PET team, psychological emergency team, the psychiatrists who you can ring up and they can come out in cases of emergency, because the guy needed help. And as soon as these psychiatrists started coming out, came to him and started telling him that he probably had to be committed and going to a mental hospital, he started to change. Something inside of him did not want to be committed to a mental hospital. Whether it was pride or whether it was fear, I don't know, but that triggered him to calm down. And the PET team left and he was fine. They cured him just with the fear of being committed. Same thing, that same self-preservation there. So you can actually see that what Ajahn Chah saw there is actually with a lot of people. He goes so far, but it's only so far. And then that self-preservation kicks in and sort of makes everything calm and peaceful. So that's the sort of wisdom and insight which, you know, you see with these people, these great monks and nuns who have developed their mind. You can see much deeper into the nature of things, and it's extremely effective. And so that insight, it's great to have that insight into the nature of the mind, because, and the nature of relationships, the nature of life, because that's going to save a lot of problems for you. So when you have insight, get that insight very strong, the mind very peaceful, and then if you have a problem, then pick it up and look at it. But if your mind is peaceful, so if your mind is not peaceful, it's agitated, it's worried, it's upset, it's tired, it's a complete waste of time trying to work out your problems. You just make more problems. So the only way to solve the problems of life is to put them down for a while. Do some meditation. Once the mind is peaceful, then you've got perspective. Then it's like a leaf falling on an empty path. Whatever the problem is, you can see it. Okay, this is a problem, this is what I should do. So the insight meditation is not just insight in getting enlightened, it's insight in solving your problems, which you have to deal with in your life, whether it's problems of sickness, impending death, old age, problems with your family, problems with your business, or whatever. But of course, the greatest of insights is that the insight into the nature of reality, truth. But before you can get onto that one, the other insight which I encourage you is the insight into the path of meditation. What actually works, how meditation works, what you have to do. And so far, most of the insight which I've been talking about at the moment is that insight into how meditation works, how to get the mind peaceful. So here, what you should do is every time you get into meditation, or start meditating, if you come to a blockage anywhere, stop, stand back, and look. What is going on? Don't keep fighting the obstacles just through brute force. Wisdom power or insight power is always more strong than willpower. So whenever I meditate and I get to a stage and I can't get any further, I just stand back and look. I stop trying. Why? What's going on here? Because that insight into the way of meditation is what will actually help. Usually what works for me is that if I get stuck in any stage of meditation, it's because I'm not centered enough in the present moment. Usually. So the present moment gets a bit fuzzy, I'm a little bit on the edge, a little bit in the past, a little bit in the future. Especially a little bit in the future, expecting something which is going to happen next. Why isn't it happening yet? That's future. Or in the past, and it's not going well. What I mean is it hasn't gone well yet. You're lingering in the past. And so often, I've seen this so often, I can stand back and see fuzziness of present moment awareness. And I really sharpen it. And I really, one moment, that's all. A precise moment. And so precise in that present moment, there cannot be any expectation for the future, because there isn't any future in that precise present moment. And there's no concern at all about what I've just done. Even just what happened just a fraction of a moment ago. That's all gone. It's so precise. Because in that precision of a present moment, there's just no craving. This craving hasn't got room to move there. And that for me was a marvellous insight to say, precise present moment. At any stage, even when you're on the breath, focus in on the breath, that part of the breath, that instant of the breath happening right in this moment. Nothing else. That stops all thought, that stops all movement, and in that present moment you can see the beautiful contentment. Understanding also what contentment is, because if there's any problem in the meditation, it's all because of discontent. You're not really happy where you are. That's why stillness does not grow. So, contentment, present moment, these are all the same thing. And what insight does, you know, you get to a stage in meditation, you get stuck, you stand back, you look, you can see the problem, you know the answer. And if it really is the answer to meditation, it means you, boom, you go deeper, straight away. That's why I say that the sign of insight is calm. Once you see the problem, then automatically you apply the solution and you're much deeper. You've overcome that obstacle. So you see that, you know, present moment awareness is a bit too fuzzy, sharpen up. As soon as you see that, I sharpen up and you go much deeper. If you're contentment, if you want a nice nimitta, and you just, you can't wait to get into a jar, you're discontent, you're messing up. Be content, you don't care whether you get into a jhana or whether you go all the way back and just open your eyes and you're disturbed. Contentment. You stand back, it's discontent. So you're just so content with that rotten old nimitta which you're up now, even though it's not perfect. Contentment. And then as soon as you give up trying to do things and are absolutely content, the nimitta just does it all for you and starts to sharpen up and just does the whole job. And these are like insights which you get on the path of meditation. The insight into sort of shutting up. Because you know what it's like, many people got, at all stages of the meditation, we keep on interrupting by thinking, by this inner commentary. You know that lovely story, this will give you a lot of confidence that you can get into deep meditations. There was a novice who was with Ajahn Chah, this, you know, little novice, about 9 or 10 years of age. And when Ajahn Chah would give a talk, he would give a talk not just for half an hour or an hour, it would sometimes go on all night. He'd just carry on talking, he wouldn't stop, 4, 5, 6 hours. And you know, there was some nice bits in there, but a lot of it was just, you know, waffle. It's true. I mean, when actually you read like these books of Ajahn Chah, you can ask anyone who's lived with Ajahn Chah, but all these little books were just the very best bits, like taking the currants out of the cake. You know, you just got the very, very, very best bits, you know, which the monks sort of, you know, sifted out from all the other stuff and presented in these, like, books by Ajahn Chah. When you read these books, you can't recognize, that's not how Ajahn Chah taught. You know, a lot of all this bits and pieces, and then you get the nice little gems. But of course, at some times, you couldn't wait for the gem and say, oh, crikey, when's he going to stop? And this is this poor little novice, again, 9 or 10 years of age, 11 years of age, however, and you know, not all that interested, you know, made to become a monk by his parents or whatever. And he was listening to Ajahn Chah one night, because he told the story to the monks afterwards. You know, and after 1 hour, 2 hours, you know, he started to think, when's he going to stop? When's Ajahn Chah going to finish? And I think you can recognize this because it becomes an obsession of the mind. And he kept on saying to himself, when's he going to stop? When's he going to stop? When's Ajahn Chah going to finish? It's 2 hours now. When's he going to stop? It's 2.5 hours. And this kept on going for, you know, over an hour, this when's he going to stop business. And Ajahn Chah was continually talking, and this novice was getting continually frustrated, more and more upset, more and more angry. When's he going to stop? He should stop. Doesn't he know we've got to go to bed? We're not all arahats like him. We need sleep. When's he going to stop? And then at a moment, sort of, he had what we call like an insight came up. More of my insight born of frustration. And an insight just changing the perspective, just a slight different change, and you see a completely different scenery. when's he going to stop, when's he going to stop, became, when am I going to stop? And this novice goes, one thought, when am I going to stop? And he stopped. When he opened his eyes again afterwards, everyone had left. The monks, Ajahn Chah, finished a long time ago, and all the monks had gone out of the hall and gone to bed. And he'd been in a beautiful meditation, just blissed out of his little mind. This wonderful little novice. He stopped. Isn't that a wonderful story? So, when you're thinking, when am I going to stop? When am I going to stop? Stop! So what stopping is stop controlling. Stop doing, stop complaining, stop doing this, stop doing that. Just stop. That's called letting go. And that's what an insight is. That insight, when am I going to stop, he actually saw what that really meant. And if you could see what that really meant, you'd be sitting here and you'd be still sitting here after lunch is finished, not moved. So that's what insight does. Things stop. The problem goes. So getting insight into the practice of meditation is powerful. It's also powerful because it starts to reveal craving, that's not craving. The story of this monk many years ago, he was eating his food in his bowl. And he was eating his food and thought, that's attachment, that's craving. So I won't eat. He pushed his bowl away. And then he thought for a minute, that's just being attached to being a good monk. So he pulled his mouth and bobbed him. And he said, no, that's just craving, just being wise. He was putting his bowl backwards and forwards because he didn't know which was craving, which was attachment. Because, you know, if he ate it, it was attachment. If he didn't eat it, it was attachment. So he's going crazy. Because we don't really know what attachment or what craving is. At least most people, they talk about these things and they look at monks and say, you're just attached to being a monk. Now why didn't you go out for Saturday night? You're just attached to your rules. Now why don't you break a few just now and again? And actually they tell you that, they say that. That's crazy. And they even say that, you know, you're getting to jhanas, that's being attached to the beautiful states of mind. And they say, well, this is crazy. What attachment is that which stops you being happy. That which stops you being free. That which fetters you. That's what attachment is. And I said, well, quite frankly, that when I wear these robes, I feel extremely free. It can't be an attachment. When I keep my precepts, I never feel as free as when I keep my precepts pure. It's like, now you would know, when you come here and you keep 8 precepts and you only eat in the morning time, have you felt that freedom yet? Yes. Yeah. It's strange, isn't it? You're keeping rules, you're in this boundary, but you feel free. In the world, we try and have more civil liberties. So more and more people can do whatever they want. You don't feel free at all. You ask people in the most anarchistic societies, do you really feel free? Nowhere near as free as like a person when they're on 8 precepts or living in a monastery. So we don't understand what freedom is, what attachment is. Unless we really can get in our minds that attachment is what liberates. Giving up attachment is what liberates. It gives freedom, it gives peace, it gives happiness. So, when we're meditating, you'd always come across blockages. And especially in the deeper meditations, this is where you come along the real nitty-gritty attachments which you have. I've talked already yesterday about when you get to the stage of these beautiful nimittas coming up. Beautiful like lights in the mind. And you reflect sometimes, why can't you be still with those nimittas? Why can't you just leave them alone? And you understand that you're attached to controlling. When you talk about control freaks, you know, each one of you, if you haven't let go of a nimitta and gone into a jhana, you are all control freaks. Because the only way to get into those jhanas is to completely let go. And you see that, the reason why you can't go deeper is because core attachment. I've always wanted to be in control. Why are you always in control? And that starts to illuminate the teaching of anatta, non-self. Because having a self means doing and controlling. Basically, letting go of the controller, of the doer, is basically trusting in non-self. And if you are attached to the idea of a self, you will never be able to make that step. That's why fear comes up at that step. You're getting a nice nimitta and you can go deeper, but you're afraid. What are you afraid of? All fear is the fear of letting go of something which you cherish, which you think is important, which you think is vital. That's why you feel so afraid. So when that fear comes up, that is the beautiful place where insight can arise. What am I afraid of? What you're afraid of is letting go of yourself. Trusting. This is why they say those deeper meditations, it takes a lot of like trust, a lot of faith. That's why people who have got a lot of faith can very easily get into those deep meditations. Even Christian mystics, because I've met a few Christian mystics, I'm pretty convinced that some of those Christian mystics in the Middle Ages, I don't think anyone these days, but in the Middle Ages, could actually get into jhanas. But what they said those jhanas were unification with God. And they came out afterwards. And I can understand why they said those things, because that's their perceptual framework. Get into these states, extremely powerful, blissful, the most powerful, blissful thing you've ever experienced in your life. And what would a Christian call that? Of course, they called it God. Wow. And also because they've given up themselves to get in there. But for a Christian, they got this amazing, like, well, again, in the Middle Ages, incredible faith, absolute faith in a God. So much so they can actually give up themselves to a God. That's why they could get into those jhanas, because they could absolutely give themselves up. The Buddhists, you have to give yourself up also to the powerful emptiness, if you like. Much better word than God. But that's scary. That is attachment. That is what's stopping you going deeper and blissing out. That's what's stopping you becoming enlightened. That's why people can't get into jhanas. There's no way they can be enlightened. Because you haven't let go of those ties. So not only does the path of samatha come actually show that you've got rid of a lot of attachments, but it also illuminates, uncovers the deeper ones. And this way it's where it really gets fun, because you're dealing with the very inner ties which stop you being enlightened. And if you can get past those and get into like a jhana, you've let go of the self. It's marvelous to let go of the self. When you come out afterwards, why have I been so scared of letting go of all this will and all this knowing? Because when you do let go of it, it's bliss. This is fun. It's the same way, why have I always been so scared of giving away all my money? Why have I been always so scared of letting go of my kids? Why has it always been so scared of cutting off my hair? And being there you go. See, it's attachment, isn't it? Because once you do it, it's fun. Why am I so scared of giving up all the little things which, you know, I attach to, all the things I keep on my mental shelf? Why have I been so scared of doing these things? And once I give them away, wow, freedom, enlightenment, peace, bliss. Because this is a path of meditation. It's almost like a microcosm, like a metaphor for the whole path of enlightenment. Letting go, giving up. You get more and more bliss. And it uncovers all these very refined attachments. We always think if we control, if we do, if we crave, we will be happy. What meditation teaches you, if you let go of craving, if you don't do anything, if you're absolutely still, then you really are happy. Complexity in the world is supposed to give you happiness. the more complex your relationships, the more you have of relationships, friends, interaction, doing this, the more complex your life is, they say, the richer your life is in the world. In the monastery, the more simple it is, the more unentangled, the happier it is. Which one is true? Find out for your insight, for your own experience when you meditate. So this is giving you real insight. Not the insight of thinking, but the insight of experience. Not the insight of logic and reason, because logic and reason is not good enough. That too is conditioned. We reason according to conditioned pathways. But we're doing it experience. This is not supposed to be happy, according to reason, but my God, it is. So this is what insight does. It challenges all of that and completely overturns even reason and logic, what you think should be happening. So that when we... actually, it doesn't really overturn logic. It overturns the assumptions on which logic is founded. And so what you start to do is you get real insight coming up. And that's insight into not just the path of meditation, but into the nature of the mind and the nature of the body. Again, with insight into the nature of the mind, this engine which is in the center of everything, to really get that insight, you have to isolate the mind, as I said a few days ago. To isolate the mind and get just the mind, when I gave that simile of the emperor covered by the clothes, you have to take all those clothes off, so you just got the emperor there, the mind, the jitta, and see what that really is. Or it's like finding the properties of gold. You've got to take away all the impurities of that gold, and so it's just pure gold, nothing but gold, just gold. That's actually the Buddha simile. And then when you've got pure gold, you can use it, you can work it, you can know what it is. When you've got pure mind, just mind, without any of the other senses or the body interfering, then you can know what this mind is, how it works. You've got the mind right in front of you in jhanas, pure, clear, teaching you. And you have to be really thick not to be able to actually see what that's teaching you. What it's teaching you is, first of all, this mind is only a process. It's not a person, not a being. It just goes according to natural laws. It's not the owner of all this. It's not owned by anything. This is just nature, that's all. And you look at that mind long enough and you'll be able to see its nature. And then you'll have no doubt at all about teachings of the Buddha. The insights will arise out of the experiential knowledge, not out of inference or thinking, out of experience. In the same way that some of you during this retreat, when you do get into nice meditations, I also ask at the end, go and try and get some past life memories. And the reason why I say that, because that's insight practice. Because once you get a past life memory coming up, and you, as I said, if it really is a past life memory, you know 100% certainly that was you. That's one of its characteristics of a real one. Without any doubt at all. Then an insight has arisen. There is such a thing as past lives. And all your doubts about rebirth and the karma will be completely abolished. And any friend who comes along and says, I don't believe in rebirth, you're just believing in a cultural accretion, you don't have to be a Buddhist, you don't have to believe in rebirth to be a Buddhist, and blah, 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 blah. You say, well, that's very well, but I know. The other day, I was actually in Thailand, I was taking a copy of the new translation of the Sangyutta Nikaya to one of the monks over there. And I was carrying one copy, one of the other monks was carrying the other volume, because it's a two-volume set. And because he wasn't in the monastery that day, he was coming the next day, I opened it, I was looking, and one of the stories I looked at there was of this householder called Chitta. It's in the Chitta Sangyutta. And this householder Chitta, he was a disciple of the Buddha, he was actually a non-returner. He was a lay person, but he got to huge high stage, and could get into jhanas, extremely wise, and no attachments to the world, only attachments to the mind left. He's a non-returner. And he went to go and see one of these Jains, actually the leader of the Jains. It was called Mahavira, who was one of the founders of the Jain religion. He was actually contemporary, lived at the same time, in the same place as the Buddha. And he went to go and see the Jain, and the Jain was saying, you know that, he said, Chitta, you're a disciple of Gotama. I wouldn't call him the Buddha, I'd call him Gotama. He said, I hear that Gotama teaches that you can still be mindful without thinking. So do you believe that? And Chitta said, no, I don't believe that at all. And Mahavira said, see, even a disciple of the Buddha knows it's absolutely impossible to be mindful without thinking. He said, it's like trying to catch the air or trying to stop the Ganges with your fist, said Mahavira. So that, you know, it's impossible to stop thinking. And said, even Chitta the householder doesn't believe it. Is that right? He said, yeah, I don't believe it, said Chitta. I know it. Because I've been in those jhanas where all thinking stops. And he really sucked my weary. But the important part of that, it was not belief. It was knowledge. And that made all the difference. And you've all heard in like Kalama Sutta, Buddhists don't believe things. They know things. So see if you can be someone who doesn't believe in rebirth, but knows rebirth. Doesn't believe in anatta, but knows anatta. Doesn't believe that there can be a state where there's no thinking and you get blissed out just sitting cross-legged without doing anything. Be someone who knows that. Because that knowledge, that is called insight. So that's the little talk this morning on insight. Do you understand? Or do you just believe? Okay, any questions on that? Yeah?
I've noticed I've never used the word attachment, because I have no attachment. Is that because attachment is a very cold?
Aha, good question. Why don't you use the word detachment? Because that's missing a point. Because what detachment means is I'm over here. That's over there. That's still attachment. There's still something in here. With attachment, attachment is a relationship. And it's some, when we talk about attachment, we only look at the object of attachment. And we stop looking at the other end of the relationship. What is doing the attaching? And that's the big problem with trying to stop attachment. We detach, we think, I'm just going to break this relationship. But that's not good enough. You make another relationship straight away. This is my simile of the hand. Attachment is like always picking up things. You know, you see me picking up things, pick up what's this, and then I pick up a cup of tea and a cup of water. Always picking up things with my hand. So I try and stop picking up things with my hand. I try and detach. I can only do it for a while. And I go pick up something again. Oh, stop it, put it down. You pick up something else, stop it, put it down. That's how people play around with detachment. They pick up something, stop, detach, put it down. They go pick up something else again. Why does that happen? It is because it is the nature of a hand to pick things up. I can't stop my hand picking things up. That's its nature. I can suppress it, I can delay it, but I can't stop it. So I realised the only way to stop myself picking things up, cut my hand off and throw it away. The only way you can stop attaching to things is to cut the hand off, the sense of self, the illusion of self, the illusion of I am the doer, I am the knower. Once that's cut off, then attachment is stopped. Otherwise, you'll still be picking something else up. That's why people say detachment. It means they've still got the knower in there, the self in there, the me in there, and they think they've stopped all attachment. They haven't. They just detach for a moment. That's not real letting go. You find that in your life. You give something up, You think you're detached. You go pick something else up afterwards. You give up one attachment, you give up, say, smoking, and then you take up coffee. So you give up one husband, you go and take up another one. Whatever else it is. This is what happens to people. It's interesting, there's a monk. Young monks are always concerned about their food. Strange thing, because you give up girls and you pick up food. Sensory pressure. And it's crazy, the first years of the monk, just food was so important to you. And sometimes that might happen here. You know, you give up one thing to come actually here, and food becomes really important to you, or sleep becomes, or something becomes important to you. You give up a lot to meditate, but be careful, you don't go, you give up one attachment, you don't go picking up something else. So that's why I don't like the word detachment, because it's not the real thing. It's letting go. Emptiness is a great word. Everything's gone. Even that which knows is gone. Nothing left. Absolutely nothing. Yeah.
How about to intervene?
To intervene, that's really complicating things.
To intervene. Because without this cup, I won't be alone.
Great.
Because I'm around and she the cup.
Absolutely. So when you both go, then you're okay.
You talk about attachment, what is the term intervene or to be intervening?
Well, that's actually part of attachment, when you're intervene with things. Because it is true that, you know, that which knows, that which does, is dependent upon what it does and what it knows.
But at the moment, it can't be possible that you are just being without being attached.
No. This old saying that Descartes said, to be is to do. And Jean-Paul Sartre said, turn it around, instead of to be is to do, he said, to do is to be. Being and doing, they go together. And it was actually the American philosopher, you know this one, Frank Sinatra said, do be, do be, do.
To love is not to possess.
That's not true. A lot of loving is really possessing. I've said this in Singapore, do you remember? I said, look, if you really love your husband, you really love your husband. Now, if he goes, while you're on retreat, if you find out that he's found this beautiful 18-year-old girl who's run off with her to have a nice sort of holiday, you should be happy for him. He's having fun. Don't you really love your husband? Absolutely. How many husbands, you know, or wives could actually do that? Because, look, I love you. I want you to be happy. Your happiness is my biggest concern. Okay. I think I made my point. So, no, it's romantic love is very illusory. And we think we're sort of, we love that person, we want them to be happy. But we want ourselves to be happy. It's an amazing thing about, this is that story about the Queen Malika looking through the palace window. One day she saw the Buddha coming on arms round. And she was so inspired and so much faith in the Buddha that when she saw the Buddha coming, that she was gazing with like adoration. And when her husband, King Pasenadi, saw her, you know, adoration looked just like love. And she thought that his wife was obsessed and in love with the Buddha. So she put her on the spot and said, who do you love more, the Buddha or me? And that's a tough question, you know, for someone who had a lot of faith in that monk. But Queen Malika was an extremely smart lady. She said, actually, I love myself more than both of you.
Yeah.
That's a smart answer, because it got her off out of trouble. if she said she loved the Buddha more than her husband, she'd have got in trouble with her husband. If she said she loved her husband more than the Buddha, she'd have got in trouble with her religion. And so she loved herself more. And that really shook, you know, the king. And, you know, but he was wise enough. He said, you know, I went straight to see the Buddha and asked him about this. So he went to see the Buddha and said, look, this is what happened. I caught my wife looking at you through the window and I got jealous. So I asked, you know, who do you love more? And she said she loved herself more. I said, what do you make of this? And the Buddha said, that was a very wise woman. He said, everybody loves themselves more than anyone else. And that's, you know, not a superficial teaching. That's actually going very deep. We might think we love our kids. We might think that we love our husband, that we fully, you know, love those people. But if you look very deeply, you love the way your wife makes you feel. You know, you love having your kids around. Because, you know, if your kids were very happy in another part of the world, are you happy? It's one of the things which my mother told me. So when I asked, can I be a monk? She said, I don't mind you being a monk, but I'd rather you be a monk in London, right next door to me, so I can visit. Yeah, you can understand that, can't you? Because her love was actually, she loved having me around, seeing your kids, hugging them, being with them. So there's a lot of self-love in there. So be careful in single love. If it really is loving kindness, then you'd be happy no matter what your kids do. And you'd be happy no matter what your wife does as well. If your wife has got this wonderful toy boy, you're just so happy for her. So I think I made a point. I think we've gone on quite long and I'm getting late for the interview. So thanks very much. Any more questions, please ask them afterwards.